Welcome to the pod, everyone. A shout out to SGS.
Hey, Rusty, why are we partnering with SGS?
Some good people there. Pretty excited about their sports coaching courses and sports courses. Keen to make them industry ready, so when people leave, they're able to go and transfer it to any kind of industries, coaching, teaching, being an analyst, business, whatever it might be. So I think it's pretty exciting times, really.
So what's so special about their degree courses that others won't be doing?
I think it'll be lots of real good partnerships, opportunities for people to get into different contexts and learn and practice. It'll be feel very applied. People will be stretched and supported and will leave ready to just go and thrive in the big old world out there.
SGS College is the home of Bristol's higher education sports programmes. The programmes are designed to develop unique, innovative and creative sports practitioners ready for industry. Do you want to be a coach or teacher of the future? Start your journey here at SGS College and become more than just a graduate. Visit sgscol.ac.uk to apply now.
Andy Lockwood, how the devil are you?
I'm great, thanks, mate. How are you?
I'm cool. Well, I'm in a hotel room in Portugal. You are in a nice part of the world in Canada, 3 hours outside Toronto. Jealously, I was very jealously observing the view from your window earlier.
It's lovely, isn't it? You can't quite see the Toy Story sky, but it's blue skies. It's about 3 degrees, 2-3 degrees today, but it is blue skies and sunshine at the moment.
Nice. Well, I've been in the sea today for tenny consolation, and on two beaches. So, mate, good to have you on. Well, the face behind rugby vacancies, so we're going to delve into a bit of rugby vacancies and then maybe delve into a bit of culture-y type stuff. So do you want to give a quick intro as to who the devil you are?
Thanks, mate. So hopefully some of your listeners will be aware of rugby vacancies, but it's something I've been doing for a few years now, and in a nutshell, it provides people with a portal for jobs in rugby around the world. Could be whether you're playing, whether you're coaching, whether you're in communications, marketing, ticketing, whatever job is involved in rugby from anywhere in the world, it gets put in one place. And so people can go on there. It's free to view. All of the links either take you directly to the job itself, or there's always an email point of contact, and it's always free for someone to go in there and have a look and get the job of their dreams in rugby.
Yeah, you're like head of midlife crisis in my world. So like all those women and men who get to like a little bit younger than me, so like late 30s, early 40s, start to realise that coaching or sport, they want it to be a bigger part of their life, if not all of their life, but be careful what you wish for, then I would point them your way. And then I sometimes like struggle to sleep at night because I'm wondering, like, does Andy like troll all the websites, or is there like a bot that like does it? So like, yeah, maybe just give a shout out to like, and as we were just chatting about there off air, like, it's not just like coaching, is it? Like there's some quite interesting jobs, I guess, emerging as the game moves on.
There are. And what's interesting is over the few years I've done it, there's been more outside of your kind of core roles about coaching, S&C, performance. Well, actually, you know, your young student who's maybe looking at videography or film as a career, well, instead of going to the BAFTAs or the Oscars, actually Exeter Chiefs and Bristol Bears have both just advertised for a videographer. So it's a route that actually some people might not have considered. And there's more jobs coming, I think, anyway, in that area. There'll be more variety, especially in the kind of marketing comms, social media. So if that's your thing, then great. But yeah, I do all the, I post everything from coaching, performance analysis, S&C, marketing, legal, all the way from your kind of RFU, all the way down to, you know, Kingston Panthers second team.
Oh, poor old Kingston. And like, who wouldn't want to go to Exeter as opposed to the Oscars, hey? Form an orderly queue. And do you find the jobs or does the bot find it?
I do. It actually doesn't take me very long because I've been doing it for a while. I know where to look.
I found a job once, and I think I found it before you. And I was like, come on, Rusty.
Come on. But it's all me. It's all done by me. But now I know where to look. And it probably takes about less than an hour of my day, if I'm honest, because I know where I'm looking.
Every day?
No, Monday to Friday. I don't do it at the weekends, but yeah, Monday to Friday.
So, yeah, it's still a lot of days. Well, yeah. It's a great public service.
Thank you. Thank you. Hopefully, I don't get much people. I know one or two people have got jobs from seeing them of what I post. But hopefully there's a few out there who've got a job, who've got the job they want because of that. That'd be nice to think.
Nice, yeah. And of course, like, you're constantly trying to tempt me away from Bristol with job offers.
Nothing in the Maldives yet, mate.
Quite frankly, my wife is having absolutely nothing to do with. Like, you know, there's a job in Fiji. It's like, oh. Yeah, Mrs. E is definitely going to say no to Fiji. How far is it from Bristol, she'll say. Mate, cool.
Well, a bit of a commute, that, isn't it?
Yeah. A bit of a plug there, definitely. So at Rugby Vacancies on Twitter, and actually you've got a Facebook page as well, haven't you? So I guess...
Yeah, Facebook and Instagram as well.
You got LinkedIn?
I am on LinkedIn. It's just me. So it's my profile picture. And then if people search for Andrew Lockwood, all of the stuff goes on LinkedIn as well.
Awesome. Job done. Let's talk about the other stuff in your life. So, like, do you want to, like, give a bit of a biography of, like, you that might help explain, like, why you were speaking to Scott Robertson about some stuff?
Yeah. No, we'll get to that in a minute. He's a fascinating individual. So I was born in Devon, lived a long time in Devon, but I spent 6 years living in Papua New Guinea as a kid. Parents were teachers, and so I did everything from kind of Salvation Army preschool to running around in the eastern villages in the eastern highlands, you know, playing with other kids and chasing pigs and stuff like that. I've got a definite memory of me with a little friend chasing wild pigs through the village. I must have been about four or something like that. So PNG for a few years, back to school.
Just to clarify, you were chasing pigs in PNG, not Devon.
Yeah. Well, there probably are a few pigs in Devon, but yeah. I've never chased any. And the school in Devon, went to, took a year out after school to go and play rugby in Australia. I spent a year for a season in Perth, ended up playing for Western Australia. Didn't get a chance to have a game in front of the Australian selectors. Probably quite a good thing because the guys I'd have been playing against would have been breaking into the squad in about the 2003 World Cup. And at centre, they had some pretty strong competition. So I think that was a blessing in disguise.
Who did you have? Elton Flatley, Stirling Mortlock.
So I was at the under-19. So the young guys who were breaking into the Australia squad around about kind of 2003, I would have been up against. I can't think off the top of my head who that might be, but there were some pretty strong strong players in that Wallabies team around that time of year. So then university in Cheltenham. It was a college of higher education when I went, but turned into a university while I was there.
How old are you now?
41.
Okay, so my wife was there 4 years before you.
Okay, brilliant. Lovely place. Yeah, and if I left Cheltenham's where I met my wife as well. She wasn't a student at the time. That's why I met her. So finished university, looking around for. As a lot of students do, looking around for something to do. I had a mate who just joined the army. I met with him and he told me about it. I thought, yeah, that sounds like a bit of a wheeze. I'll have a go at that. And without really thinking too hard about it, I found myself day one at Sandhurst thinking, what am I doing here? And then 17 years later, I'm still in the army and I find myself in sunny Canada. As you can see the blue skies and the sunshine.
Yeah, nice. Keeping the world safe.
Sort of, yeah. So at the moment, I'm doing a lot of stuff to do with simulation. So virtual constructive simulation, which is interesting because it means I get to run around with plastic guns and shoot lasers. So it's a bit like Laser Quest, but with a sort of a military aspect to it.
Nice. It just made me think: would the army ever pick up people from esports? Just kind of, you know, again, like they'll be doing loads of those simulations, won't they?
So, and we're also looking at virtual stuff in terms of, you know, put a headset on, you know, classic kind of, you know, virtual headset. You're living in a world. You know, you go and do stuff. You interact with people as part of training. So instead of going and doing it live in the cold, the wet and the rain, or the snow as in Canada, we're looking at doing stuff virtually.
Nice, mate. Exciting stuff. And come on, let's get into Sir Razor Robertson. Like, how did you end up on a call with the man, the myth?
So one of the jobs I've done in the army was at a place called Westbury, tiny little town near Bath. But for about 70 plus years, there's been a small camp in Westbury where every person who wants to join the army as an officer goes and does their initial selection. And one of the jobs I had down there was as an assessor, so to develop and select those for the leadership roles to go to Sandhurst. I was quite lucky in that Danny Grucock turned up one day for a visit when he was the academy manager at Bath. So through that connection, I then spent two seasons at the academy as a strength and conditioning intern, just on the fitness side with some of the academy guys. That was interesting. And some of those guys are now getting first team gigs, which is great to see. So there was a sort of a rugby connection with that side of things. As well as that, a couple of times in my army career, whether that be just before operations or during operations, I've had to kind of take over small teams because the guy who was in charge at the time has either been injured or has to be replaced. So there was quite a few times in my career, whether that be on purpose or by accident, where I found myself having to take over a small team and develop the culture and the team really at short notice in order to then go and carry on whatever we were doing, whether that was in barracks or in operations. It's happened a couple of times. And that, along with my experience of sort of assessing leadership, and then helping those people coming through develop their own leadership. And we also did work with people like Lloyd's, Tesco, the FA. So I wasn't on the visit, sadly, but Gareth Southgate turned up when he was part of the England under-21s team, when he was with the coaching side, to look at leadership and cultural development and what the army does. Unfortunately, I wasn't on the visit, so I can't claim any credit for any of that. But we did stuff with a load of organisations, civilian sporting organisations, to look at how they can develop their culture. One really interesting group was a group called Teach First. I'm not sure if they're still going. They probably are. But their remit was to take high-performing graduates and put them into low-performing schools as teachers. But they had a 50% dropout within 12 months. And what they wanted to look at is how could they assess for grit and determination and resilience and stuff like that. And so they came down for a visit and we kind of showed them what the army does and how we do it. So that was really interesting. So we did a whole load of work with different organizations. So all of that coupled together with, it really got me thinking about, and there's three areas that I looked at. So whenever I had to sort of take over a team at short notice, or if something had happened, someone had to step in. Leadership is very easy in a fertile environment. But if you want to make something grow, it's really difficult if it's barren and lifeless. And so there was three things that I always did. The first one is I was always trying to develop a shared experience amongst the group. However big the team was, it didn't matter, but some kind of shared experience, ideally positive. But being in the military, sometimes it's a negative experience. You might be cold, wet, hungry, tired, all of that. But then over time, that negative experience is bonding and it allows to do more. So shared experience was one. The second was shared understanding. And that was, I wanted each of the people in the team to understand each other, where they came from, what made them tick. But not just each other, where they fitted in the team, the understanding of the purpose, our kind of broader aspect. What were we doing and why? So it wasn't just an understanding of each other, but it was an understanding of the wider aspect and the wider, bigger picture. And the third thing, which was probably the most important, was trying as an individual to show huge amounts of empathy, because I think it's a really underrated characteristic, being empathetic. And people might talk about, they think about the military and they don't immediately think of empathy and kindness and understanding, but actually it's those things that really develop trust. So if you can show empathy and you can receive empathy, you can develop trust. And trust is one of the biggest things in the military that we look at. So those three things really, the shared understanding, shared experience and empathy. Scott, I got in touch with him a couple of years ago, and I connected Mark Jones, who's now at Worcester, to raise
my dream job. You connected Mark Jones to my dream job.
Yes.
Just to clarify. And,
and so Mark went down after the World Cup. Mark went down and coached. I think, was he there for a season or two seasons? He took over from Irish guy. I'm having a moment.
Ronan O'Gara.
Ronan O'Gara, thank you. Yes, took over from Ronan O'Gara. And then subsequently moved to Worcester. But because of that, I'd been in touch with Razor. And I heard you speaking to him on your pod about 2 years ago, which, if anyone's listened to this, I think they should probably go back and listen to it again because it was really good. And I got in touch with him and said, oh, look, yeah, you talked about theming and there's a couple of points you made. And I said, well, actually, these are the 3 points that, you know, here's the kind of experience I've had. And these are the 3 points. These are three areas that I always look at. And we set up a chat. It was when New Zealand were in their first major lockdown, although they could leave to do their sort of hour of exercise. So he said, we started the conversation and he said, give me a minute. And I was a bit of noise in the background. And then he said, oh, I'm just getting on my bike. And I was like, oh, okay. Which is unlucky he told me that, actually, because at some point in the conversation, it all went silent and all I heard was this heavy breathing. So if he hadn't have told me he was on a bike, I know Kiwis can be a bit funny, but that would have been a bit strange. But luckily he told me he was on a bike and he stopped and he said, sorry, I'm going uphill. So that's why I'm breathing heavily. Ah, my, got it. Okay, cool. So we ended up having a chat about theming, how the Crusaders would look at developing their culture and what the military and what my experience could do to sort of assist a sports team in developing that positive culture.
Nice. And what stuff do you think you took from that? Did you feel like he would come across as quite curious to me? Do you think he was taking some stuff from you?
Yeah, we talked a lot about, we discussed the 3 points, the shared experience we discussed, the shared understanding. He asked a lot of questions about that and how players can develop understanding, how the players can then understand each other, but then understand the organization they're in as well. And we discussed things like words and images. So for example, I would say that, the army used to, let's think about kind of, Napoleonic Wars and stuff like that and Waterloo. Well, you had guys in bright red, thick woolen jackets all standing around a piece of colourful silk. Yeah, you know, it was called the colours, and actually, people died rather than give that to the enemy. Well, it's just a wooden pole with a bit of silk. But the imagery on there and the context that was given meant that people would give their life for what was a bit of silk. And so we discussed imagery and how wording associated with imagery can then produce that kind of effect where you're looking at a team not necessarily dying for a bit of silk, but how you can draw players together and you can create that environment, you can create that culture by actually not just talking, but you can use images as well.
Nice, cool. I want to delve into some of the stuff, but I'm actually curious really around the how do you assess leadership? So what's the stuff that you'd be doing in that area?
So from an army perspective, and the other services do it slightly differently, but from an army perspective, this little barracks in Westbury has been there for about 70 plus years, and there's a lot of background information. What they did a few years ago is they worked out what attributes the army wants people to show. And then thought, well, it's quite difficult to say, does someone have, I don't know, let's say charisma, Is someone charismatic? Well, you could say yes or no. Well, how would you rate that on a scale of 0 to 10? So you have to give a score. You have to give something. You have to score something that's actually really subjective. So over time, and with quite a lot of effort, actually the Army's come up with a list of attributes that are scored from 1 to 10. And each of those points has a definition of what you look for. And so it could be leadership, it could be determination, confidence. So each of those attributes has a score associated with it. So that is one way of turning something that's very subjective. So is someone a good leader? Well, you know, you could look at examples around the world. You know, some would argue Scott Robertson's a very good leader. Some would argue, that's using another Kiwi version, Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister, some would say she's a very good leader. Some would say that Hitler wasn't a very good leader. Well, it's an awful example, but, you know, Hitler was a fantastic leader. Awful, awful concept and ideas behind it, but he galvanized an entire nation and took them to war. So it's, the difficulty was always putting a score to something that's very subjective. But over time, the Army's done that. And so that's one way of doing it. And so I went back, and when I was there, I had a look at my scorecard from when I went through and what I scored. And I was surprised at the things that were identified. I still do now. And I was there after, I think I'd been in the Army about 10 years by the time I went back, eight or nine years by the time I went back there. And I thought, wow, I still do things now that were identified 8 or 9 years ago, just from the sort of, you know, 5 days I was there.
The good stuff, hopefully. And I guess leadership's contextual, isn't it? So, yep. Like, you would also, like, have to create some scenarios that would feel like the right thing, because Scott Robertson might not be the right person to lead. I think he'd be great at Man United at the moment, but he might not be the right person for, let's say, Watford or someone like that.
You're right. And the context is always, when you always see this in sport, is a successful manager leaves and the person who replaces him never quite does so well. But it's the next person who replaces him that seems to sort of take the team on and do really well. And that's a tough ask. And especially in something like professional sport, where you are, you know, there is an economic and financial element to your success. And so I think that the Army is quite good in that it allows you to be a leader. It allows you the time to do it. It allows you the time to develop. So I've been in 17 years now. Other people have been in longer, other people in shorter. But you know, if you join the Army, you are given that opportunity. And it's not a case of you're going to get sacked after the season if you don't get the results you want. So actually, the military is quite lucky in that respect.
And then in terms of the leadership development, like, how intentional do you think it is? Is it?
So very. So from a military perspective, you know, every time you promote into a position of authority or leadership, there is an element of training that goes with that. So it's very intentional. And you are put in situations that test that leadership and test your ideas and your concepts. And the military gives you the chance to show your leadership. From the very basic, you turn up on day one for your assessment at Westbury and, you know, straight away you're given the opportunity to show that you've got a bit of leadership. As you move on up through the ranks and you spend more time, absolutely, you are put into positions where you have to do it. And actually, that allows you to grow. It allows you different ideas. It allows you to explore your own leadership, because no one's the same. There's a huge variety of people who and means by which they can do it. And actually having the opportunity to explore who you are and how you lead or manage actually is quite important. And that's something that I suspect that professional sporting organizations might not be able to do, because they're after results. So if someone says, look, I've got a 3-year contract, first 2 years is going to be iffy, third year is going to be all right. If after the first season, you know, you're on a 50-50 win-loss rate, the board, even though, you know, you agreed a 3-year contract, the board are probably going to be looking at you thinking, you know, come on, let's get a bit better than this. But luckily, the army allows you that chance to develop as an individual and develop as a leader as well. And that goes all the way through the ranks.
Here's some reflections while you were speaking. And Teach First still exists, you'll be pleased to know.
Oh, good. That is good. They were a really nice bunch of the people that turned up. And I thought, what a great idea. Hopefully, what we discussed on their visit, hopefully managed to change something. I don't know. But if they're still going, that's great news.
Yeah, hopefully their percentages are higher. But again,
I hope so, yeah.
Clearly, your talent, idea, and development is important in that environment. And then I just checked whether or not there's a... Because, again, I was at my son's school the other day and we were breaking the rules of school. And we were deciding what GCSEs will exist in 10 years, and there is currently not a GCSE in leadership. Isn't that fascinating? Like, we start talking about like esports or the environment or politics, which I'm, you know, just a better understanding of, like, you know, or taxes or financials, but there should probably be a GCSE in leadership. And then I got thinking a bit about, you know, oh, well, I can't focus on leadership because I'm looking after results. Of course, really good leadership is probably more likely to lead to more results. But of course, my experience is that sport's just playing at it. Like they're definitely, and we've got Craig White coming on the pod soon and doing some amazing stuff in this area around self-awareness and being you and understanding, like, yourself. And I think the people that are, like, designing leadership groups and saying we're doing leadership aren't. I'm dropping that bomb now. I think they use the word leadership. I think they're like, but is it intentional? Is it like, yeah, is it creating the right environments to kind of challenge, stretch, support, grow, nudge people around leadership with appropriate support, you know, or mentorship or whatever it might be? My experience is no, in lots of places, but not all places. And I was just having had those reflections, I mean, and we'll definitely delve into the sport. I'd just maybe turn the mirror on the army now and go like if you could give the army one gift in this area, what would it be? Because I ask, you know, again, lots of people go to the army and go, oh, they do this, yep, they do that. And sometimes, like, it doesn't work.
Oh, that's a great question. So,
tell everyone what you're up to at Core 37.
Hi, Fletch. We're a teamwear brand based in the Northeast, and we're the sister company of Oddballs. We've got the largest sports sublimation factory in the UK, and we've produced for the biggest brands in Europe over the past 7 years. But with Core 37, our in-house brand, you can now access those prices direct to the customer.
Why would people use Core 37?
If I was to pick three, Fletch, it would be our lead time of 3 to 4 weeks, our price, which is lower than anybody else in the industry, and the fact that we're made here in the UK.
What's the stuff you're most proud of with Core 37?
Oh, there's loads of stuff, but the key one for me would be working for a company that genuinely believes in its own mission statement, which is to produce performance sportswear at an affordable price. And then underpinning that is the people. Everybody who works here is involved in grassroots sport in some way. And so we genuinely care about what we're doing here. Fletch, why do you want to partner with Core 37?
Apart from the fact you're a Geordie, great people, lots of people involved in sport, really affordable and top quality. Thanks for joining us, Wilkie. Anyone who wants to find out more can go and have a play on their website at core-37.com, or they can reach out directly to tom@core-37.com.
Great question. So, I'd almost say if you could give the army what would it be? I think the one thing that really unites a team, and certainly in my experience, regardless of which bit of the army you're in or bit of the military, and that's trust. So the ability to generate trust at all levels across all organizations would be enormous, because as soon as someone doesn't trust their superior or their chain of command, then, you know, you've effectively lost the fight. If they don't trust you, it's really difficult to build trust, or it can be a tough road, but it's really easy to lose it. And so I think that would, if I could give the army one thing, if I give them absolute superpower, it would be the ability to generate trust. and maintain. Well, yeah.
Nice. It's a good gift. I mean, clearly it's like really important, isn't it? And as you said, like, well, it's a chemical reaction in your body and it's really easy to lose it. And I think it's helpful for coaches and leaders to understand like how you build it and how you can lose it. And God, you can lose it quick. Again, there'll be some environments where, and we'll often, you know, the phrase you'll hear is the coach has lost the players. And that's, I mean, there's no trust. And
as soon as you hear that, you just sort of cringe inside thinking, oh, I bet that doesn't
matter. Yeah, and of course, like, if only they, like, knew or they asked or they, like, and I feel stressed for, you know, there'll be a couple of things that I'm aware of at the moment. And, like, if only they would, like, listen or reach out to the players and just go, look, how can we move forward from this point? I think that would already create some trust pretty quickly. Where do you think this fits in with sports? So, I mean, how do you see it fitting in? So your kind of three-pronged attack around experiences and understanding and kind of empathy to create trust. Where do you think it fits in?
So I think there's a couple of areas. So in terms of shared experience, you and I have played sport for a number of years. Everyone always goes through the same kind of pre-season. But actually, it would be a really brave team manager or coach to say, you know what? We're not going to focus on fitness at pre-season. We're not going to thrash you. Actually, you're going to sweat a bit, but you're going to do it in a very intentional way. What we're actually going to do is we're going to provide you with 4, 5, 6 weeks of experience, whether that was related to the sport or it was outside of the sport, so you're pushing the players outside of their comfort zone, but 6 weeks of experience. Now that you can wrap up your kind of pre-season stuff in, you know, in a physical experience, but actually I think at the end of that pre-season you would have a team that would have shared so much, because that shared experience would generate a lot of things. It would generate communication between the players. So you might have young players coming up, you might have players returning from injury, you might have established players. Well, actually, you need all of them to communicate effectively. So almost forcing a lot of experience at them will create those connections and that communication. So I'd love it if someone came out at the end of next season and said, yeah, we didn't do a bleep test. Actually, what we did was something else. And it was based on experience and based on generating experience for that squad. So that's the experience. The shared understanding, I think, would
be... And I just pick up on a couple of threads and let's jump on to the next one. But, and of course, that's Saracens, like going away to the beer festival. And, you know, after all of those shared experiences, perhaps not being physiologically as in good a place as possible, but winning every game afterwards because they're connected. We got a running joke with the cricket people working with. The fitness testing can no longer be on day one. Again, it signposts some stuff. So if we do fitness testing on day one and connection on day two, we think fitness testing is more important than connection.
Exactly. Yep.
And again, I just did a cool thing with one of the women's franchises where we actually went through their timeline because they're relatively immature as a sport. Like, actually, it started in 2015, but it's the last 2 years, really. And just went through like the highs and the lows and talked through those experiences and had loads of people crying and hugging, and that's the type of stuff I would believe in. But also, like, how often is team building a one-off? Like, when we've lost? Well,
not even a one-off, it's half an hour. They'll do some sort of command task for 20 minutes and then they're going to go, right, that's that tick, let's move on to the bleep test. Great.
Connection is something you do every week. And then also, like, again, my reflection of getting back into real life is, like, you've probably got to do it in person. So those experiences you're talking about, again, like I'm with a load of lads here in Portugal who like play rugby all over the world, and they all like understand why rugby is so great. It's like the shared experiences, it's the people you meet, it's the good times, it's the tough times, it's playing at Rotherham in the early 2000s. That's the, because you definitely weren't doing it for the money, you were doing it for that. And that was the magic. And I guess, again, like, if I'm, let's think aloud about, like, junior teams? Again, like, how many shared experiences are you creating for them? Or are we just going from training to matches to, like, on the hamster wheel?
And so that was one of the things that I helped introduce at Bath Academy. So when Gruy was, I think it was his last season before he went to Oundle. So they'd get the 16s in 1 week and the 18s in the other for 3 days at a time. And one entire day was based on the kind of leadership and group development, which is quite a lot considering they're only there for sort of four days, three nights, I think it was. And we would get on the 3G pitch and we'd have a little round robin of activities and tasks, which were not necessarily rugby related, but actually it was about generating experience for the players to communicate. Because you know, kids from all over, different schools, different places, they never met before. And suddenly you're expecting them to be a high performing team in a professional academy. So that was really interesting. And that worked out well. I did that a couple of times. But I'd love to see more of that, of less shuttle sprints and more experience. And to be honest, it could be something outside. It could be what stresses people a lot is often performance. So having to speak in front of a group or having to do something in front of a group that isn't play rugby, well, actually, that's going to create an experience for that team, that group, and that individual, probably more powerfully than it is just, right, we're going to go and have 30 minutes of opposed touch, or we're going to do some transition work or whatever it is. They'll remember the bit where they were pushed out of their comfort zone, and they'll remember that experience rather than that 60-minute training session.
Mate, I'm loving your rugby chat. It sounds like you could coach professionally. That was excellent. The transition and the opposed touch sounded remarkable. Yeah, I mean, I'm nodding vociferously. And I guess the other thing is that my experience also of that is, like, you can have those experiences, but actually if you don't skillfully make sense of some stuff, it sometimes is just like a random experience, like that sometimes we're a bit confused by it.
And you're right. And that's kind of where the understanding comes in that players can then understand why they're doing something and what it's going to lead to, as opposed to, you know, right, get on the minibus, we're going to go to Wales and we're going to walk up the Penny Fan for 3 hours. And everyone goes, okay, that's great. Well, actually, if you can develop the understanding between the players and between the staff, why they're doing it, what you're trying to achieve, that will get that buy-in. And sometimes that's difficult to do. Sometimes it's easier, but that buy-in is what sort of can help cement that experience and that understanding.
And in the military, like, so when you're talking about shared understanding, I guess you're talking about purpose, like either of this mission or why does this team exist? I think you're probably talking a bit about, like, understanding yourself and your strengths. And again, often, like, that's neglected. And then also it's like, what do people bring to this team? So what are they, what's their kind of unique qualities or the qualities they're bringing that is going to help us, like, be effective?
Absolutely. So you've got young guys in the military who know exactly what they're doing because they're given a role and the responsibility and authority that comes with that role. So they know, and that's when, you know, wording comes into it. They know that the attributes associated with that title or that role, they implicitly understand it. And that's because that's a cultural fit. But you could apply that to a sports team. So you could say, right, the role of a hooker, you know, so you could give them their list of tasks, which is, right, this is exactly what we expect you to be able to do. Here's the other things we might want you to do as well. And it could be carrying the loose, hit a double miss pass, step and go, whatever it might be. But actually, you're defining that person's role so that they can understand where they fit within the team and within the culture. Might not necessarily be just playing as well. You know, you say, okay, great, we define that player's playing role, but actually off the pitch, we want you to do, you could be the senior academy mentor. We want you to go and coach the under 16s or something. So you're defining their role on and off the pitch, and it gives them purpose and it gives them a reason why. What it also does is it provides more experiences for that individual to then develop as a person. And we know that if you can develop as a person, better player.
Yeah, and just to give a build on that, so I know England are currently playing around with trademarks, and the players going, these are the two or three things I bring to this team that I can control and I can practice. Like, again, I think that's like, my preference would be that the players come up with it. I'm kind of with you that I think procedure is the opposite of skill. So I think that like giving people a defined role will sometimes mean that they miss opportunities to do other stuff. You know, that it's the day Zach Mercer said to me, well, I'm not solving that problem because I'm not in the leadership team. Like sometimes the stuff we do can be unhelpful because it is so like black and white. And actually, I think there's potentially some colourful stuff. And I would have some quite strong views on leadership teams and where I feel like they fall down and how they can lead to social loafing and perhaps how they're chosen that, you know, might be, probably would have done it differently back when I coached it, you know, years and years ago. And I think I've learned some stuff along the way. So,
mate, well, one of the things that the ministry does about incorporating the junior guys is whenever we came back from patrol in Afghanistan, and this is not just me, this is most people in the army, we'd get the team together and we'd discuss what we did, what we saw, what happened, whether there was an incident or not. And every time, every person has the opportunity to speak. And I would start at what I would consider the most junior individual, and I'd ask him, what did you see? What did you think about that? You know, and if they said, oh, I saw this, I'd be like, okay, what do you think that was? And because invariably everyone in that team has eyes, ears, and they could be a point of difference. So it's no good just asking the people that have been in 10, 15, 20 years, what did you see? What did you think about it? Actually, every member of the team had the opportunity to speak. A little bit like when you have the kind of Indigenous people over here in Canada, and they sit down and the old Native Americans, and every member of the tribe has a chance to discuss policy or what they're going to do. And you start off, and the youngest person, the most junior person, gets the chance to voice their opinion on what they can. And I used to do that with each member of the team, because it meant that they would feel, instead of just plodding along on patrol and then not really doing anything afterwards, they were involved. They were part of the team. And there were times when things that they said, we then subsequently actioned. And we turned into intelligence, and then off we went and did something else. So it's a really powerful tool. And especially, I can imagine, in a sports team, hopefully not so much now, but certainly when I was coming through, as a young guy, you walk into the changing rooms and you put your bag on the bench and someone goes, yeah, you're not sitting there. It's like, all right, okay. You know, your introduction to the first team is sometimes not positive. But I didn't want that. I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want to have a team that was like that. So I made sure that every person, doesn't matter whether they just came out of training 6 months ago and it's their first operational tour, or whether they were, you know, a five tour veteran, you know, everyone got the opportunity to speak. Everyone got the opportunity to have their point of view, which makes for one massive leadership group. But then you could argue, why then have a leadership group if everyone has their opportunity to speak? I'm not sure how to skin that cat, but I think there's a few ways of doing it.
Yeah, I think it would be dynamic. In my view, it wouldn't be like a fixed number or group of people. And of course, like, why would you ask Owen Farrell when you could ask Rafi Quirk and find out like what's Rafi's view of the world, or probably check whether Rafi understands, because I imagine we'll get false positives if we ask Owen Farrell, who's been there for years and probably knows the answer to most things.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah,
so come on, mate, let's go. Empathy, last one. What's the crack with empathy in the army? That's like a bit weird, isn't it? Because I'll give a shout out to Andy Dorling. So Andy Dorling, ex-army, one of the hardest men I know, but also like one of the most empathetic. So I think
empathy is an interesting trait. And I'll start off by talking about my kids. Sometimes they're not empathetic towards each other at all. And so it's definitely something you can learn. It's definitely something you can get better at. And actually, it is a skill. There's a certain element of natural empathy some people have. But if you think that you are not particularly empathetic, it's definitely something you can work on. It's definitely a skill you can develop, and an emotion that you can improve at. So why is it important? It's important because empathy generates trust. And trust, as we've already said, is key to a lot of organizations. Doesn't matter whether it's a military or a sports team, but trust is so important. It's really easy to lose. But if you are showing empathy, if you are an individual who is showing care over others and kindness, then you will develop trust much faster and you'll get it will be a stronger bond. So I think that, and that's across it. It doesn't matter whether you work in an office or whether you work on a rugby pitch or whether you work in the army. I think trust, showing, being empathetic generates trust. And therefore, without that, I think it would be difficult to have a positive culture, and it'd be difficult to have what some might call good leadership without empathy. And if you look back in history, some of the greatest leaders have shown huge amounts of empathy. And they are loved by their followers because of the empathy they show. I think a modern example potentially is New Zealand PM, Jacinda Ardern. From an outsider's perspective, she is a very, very strong, capable leader with huge amounts of empathy, which I think is in some people, I think it can be difficult to be a very strong leader and also show empathy as well. And I think if you can get that right, I think that's the magic sauce.
Yeah, I think empathy is strong, but that's it's just my view of the world, isn't it? Guess what, those words, and obviously compare and contrast that with our current leader, and we might be struggling to find much empathy going on there. I mean,
funny being out here and seeing it from an outsider's perspective.
All the lads are talking about. So I was just telling the Portuguese guys go, oh, okay, you lads are, you're pretty, it's not good stuff. I won't share it. But I'm going, mate, we're not all like that. Please speak. He said, oh, you're really kind. Like, are you sure you're from England? And I guess and I agree with you. Like, I think it's a skill and I think you can train it. And I guess we develop it as probably as we have kids and probably by observing our wives. I definitely developing it by observing my wife, who's she's got a PhD in empathy, and I'm just started doing, I've just about passed my 11 plus. how in your world are you developing it?
So when I was younger, I definitely made the mistake of not listening enough, 100%. I would have an idea, and because I was in what you could coin a sort of leadership role, I would say, oh, well, I've got the idea and therefore I'm in charge. Let's go and do it. That was the wrong. It was the wrong way of doing it. And actually, empathy really, in my view, starts with listening. So it's listening to what your team said, listening to the people around you. And then once you listen, you can then understand who they are, where they're coming from, and actually really what they're talking about. Because someone might come to you and start talking about something else. But actually, the more you listen, the more you realize that, okay, they haven't come to talk to me about A. Actually, they've come to talk to me about B. And that's the issue. And because you've listened and passed judgment, you haven't said, right, I've got a plan, you're going to go and do A, B, and C, off you go. Actually, because you've listened to them, you are generating that trust and that connection between you and the other person. So empathy really starts, in my view, with listening. And I've had to, certainly, in my younger years, definitely had to listen a lot more. And as I've got older, I've listened a lot more and talked a lot less. That's one skill I've had to work on. And I think that in a club environment, when you've got not much time and lots of players and you're a coach, I still think that giving 60 seconds, 2 minutes to a player to listen to what they're saying will reap huge amounts of benefit later on down the line. Mainly because they might say something really good. They might say something really insightful. And secondly, actually, that person's going to feel trusted and valued. They're going to feel part of that team because you listen to them. So really, it starts with listening.
Nice. I've definitely been working on my questioning and my listening in the last 24 hours in Portugal, because I've got a whole new group of players now. I want to understand, it was interesting because one of the players, someone messaged me and he said, I really struggled to coach him. And I don't think I got the best out of him. And I said, oh, it's fine. I'm just going to ask him later today. Like, it's easy, isn't it? Like, tell me, like, how can I get the best out of you? What's the stuff? Someone I know just messaged me and said that they didn't like focus on your strengths enough. What are your strengths? Like, cool, what, you know, what can this team do to help you? Like, you triggered me on two listening things. One is, like, you definitely got to listen with your eyes, because what people say and what they do is often, as you said, like, what's the story behind the story? As Nigel Redmond would say when his wife's telling him off and saying, like, put the bins out, it's not about the bins.
I remember that. It's story, been that tonight over here. Someone cleared the bins out.
Yeah. It's the story behind the story. My wife's good at that one. Come on, what's really wrong?
Yeah. and it's interesting because your ability to listen is often directly linked to people's view of you as an individual. So the kind of strong, charismatic leader who, you know, but actually listening and showing empathy and kindness is, whilst this sounds very strange coming from someone in the military, actually that they are qualities wherever you are that are going to result in that. You're going to develop that fertile ground I talked about earlier about, you know, culture doesn't grow in a barren environment. So without listening, kindness, empathy, you know, that feeds the soil of your culture and your environment that's going to allow you later on to develop that positive.
Martin, I love your use of analogies to create shared understanding between us around the fertile ground and the growth and the flowers and the foliage and all of that stuff. Excellent work. Razor would be very proud of you.
Yeah, I'd be fascinated to know what their theming is for this year, because the pre-season started for the Kiwis, I think, or it's about to start maybe. So it'd be interesting to see what the Crusaders theme is this year. Maybe we'll find out later in the year. I don't know.
I'll text Shane Fletcher and he'll tell me. But of course, like, isn't it interesting that, like, we're all, like, I'm genuinely quite interested in it, and it's one of the clubs I do work with. They've been theming and it was a good reflection on it when they started pre-season and all the players going, what's this season's theme?
Yeah, and I think that's the point at which the management and the coaches go, yeah, okay, we got this right.
We've hit
the sweet spot when the players are asking you about what the theme is for this year, and because the knock-on effect of that is that they're going to be engaged with, they want to know, they want to find out, so they can be part of. And that's, if anyone wants to kind of take away anything from this, I would say that Owen Eastwood's book, Belonging, is brilliant. I'm about three quarters of the way through it. I wish it had been written 15, 17 years ago when I kind of started my military career, because I would have taken so much out of that. And I know it's written by a Kiwi, and but actually what he says and the powerful examples he gives, the really good one is the when he was working with the South African cricket team. That's a great example in the book. The other one I think is Vern Cottle in Scotland, and Vern basically said to the players at the start of his 3 years, he said, at the end of 3 years, you are all going to run this team. In the first year, I'll be giving
you shared understanding, clarity.
Yep. Absolutely. And and I thought that's brilliant. And he's taken over at Fiji. And I think that, that was a really good recruitment by Fiji. Cause I think he will really suit. If he does that again with the Fijians, I think they'll really take to it.
Nice. Another shout out to Owen's book. I should definitely be getting 10%. Unfortunately, after this podcast, I'm about to message Owen and cancel our Wednesday Zoom to do the podcast, because we are having a scrimmage against the Honey Badgers. So that is...
Oh, fair enough. Yep. But,
It's a class book. And actually, the last thing really on the listening and talking about that theming, and I was just chatting to a coach today, and I was like, maybe just reflect on how many times you went to the players versus how many times they came to you. Like, again, like, we signpost eventually that we don't listen and we're not interested. And again, I'm speaking to some players who they're just given up on trying to speak to the coach. They're too scared. You know, they're there's this kind of fear going on. No one wants to raise their head above the parapet. And maybe if the coach...
It's really sad.
Yeah,
it's really sad that someone in an organisation or a team can't speak out. They can't say, oh, I've got an opinion. I've got something to say. Because
I'll make it sadder for you. It's kids. I'll make it sadder for you. It's not even grown-ups who are getting paid for it. It's kids.
That's even worse.
Yeah, it's
that's
true.
Horrendous.
Sometimes. Yeah. But again, like you're signposting some stuff, and I'm the same as you. And by the way, I'm still working on listening, and my wife's listening to this, she'll definitely like, she will confirm that I haven't got to even to the 11 plus on listening. But I am trying to stay curious, and I am trying to listen more intently and without judgment, and to seek to understand and try and work out the story behind the story. But
one thing we haven't discussed is, in terms of empathy, is potentially the ability for some to be empathetic towards what people might call the maverick, which I think it's a really awful term in rugby and in sport. I've played with people who have been coined mavericks and difficult to coach, and or they're difficult players, but they're difficult but they're brilliant players. And actually, I think the reality is that no one's really a maverick. They just think a bit differently. And if a coach was trying to shoehorn someone into their image of what a rugby player or a sports player should be, then you're going to get pushback. And so actually, yeah, if you have someone in your team who is a bit of what you might loosely call a maverick, I don't like that term, but you know, by asking them, by listening to them, by showing empathy and kindness, I can almost guarantee that maverick will not be a maverick, and actually they will be a valued part of the team.
Yeah, there should be a CPD on that alone, I would suspect. It would be helpful.
So when the RFU introduced their Mavericks module, I'm going to sign right up for it.
Yeah, let's call it the Top Gun. that would be class. Mate, look, it's been class. I'm really enjoying your kind of little framework there. It's really helpful for, I'm sure, lots of people. If people want to reach out, like, where's the best place? King of Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. So, at Rugby Vacancies across Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Or if people want to get hold of me, they can get hold of me at andy@sportvacancies.com. I think on the social media, my email is listed in the bios for each of them. If it's not, I might go and chat that now. But it should be. So if you want to reach out, it's absolutely fine. Anyone can reach out. I'm always open to DMs or emails.
Cool. People can slide into your DMs.
Andy, absolutely. Can, yeah.
It has been a pleasure, mate. Have a good... early evening in Canada, and we'll catch up soon.
Thanks. Enjoy Portugal, mate.